Our proposal was developed by law enforcement professionals and border agents at the Department of Homeland Security. These are the resources they have requested to properly perform their mission and keep America safe.
The phrase that caught everyone's attention in that December Fed statement was that the Fed judges that some further gradual increases are warranted.
Powell is among the most carefully chosen word person that I know, and the idea that that would swing markets is a sign of overexcitement of some sort.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Well, the Fed turns more dovish. This is the second week in a row that we've heard from the Fed chairman spouting they're more willing to be patient, hinting, at least the futures market confirming, well, they may not do anything, at least in the first half of the year. More trade wars could be resolved in favor to the U.S. And, of course, political discord in Washington. All of that, but despite of it, the markets were positive this year, and we are in positive territory for the year. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me in Hour 1 will be John Kosar. He's talking about two key levels that need to hold here if we're going to see this market continue to rally. One is on the S&P, and the other one is for gold. And out of Asbury's indicators, four are in positive territory. The other thing he says, we could see a flip judging on fund flows of moving money out of bonds back into stocks. And when it comes to 2019, you are going to need to be sharp on your toes to navigate these markets. It will be difficult. Also in the second half of the program, Dan Steffens will join me. We'll take a look at why did oil drop 45% in 2 months, and now we're back up 25%. The industry is running harder to keep up with 80% depletion rates in the shale patch. And breaking down, Wall Street is saying we need $100 oil for this to work. Sorry, folks. A lot of these shale companies can make it work at $55 a barrel. And according to Dan, thank God we have electric vehicles. Otherwise, we'd be talking about much, much higher oil prices than where we stand. And we're going to talk about an indicator that's a warning that we could be facing higher oil prices in the second half of the year. Nobody is watching this, and this is the key indicator to follow. Forget all that talk about inventories. This is the indicator you want to monitor. And, of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And in Hour 2, The Big Picture, Jim Poplava and I discuss our annual forecast, where we give you our own view of the markets for 2019. While there's been talk of a recession in 2019 or 2020, the numbers seem to tell a different story, and some of our conclusions may surprise you. We discuss what triggered the sell-off in oil and what happens when you approach the end of a Fed rate-raising cycle. Also discussed is the escalation of the trade war between the U.S. and China and, of course, political discord as we now make history with the longest government shutdown ever. Stay tuned for Hour 2, The Big Picture, where we discuss fast and furious. Time to buckle up. Now let's turn to Ryan Poplava to talk about the catalysts and drivers moving the financial market this week.
Chris, the primary driver this week was the ongoing technical rally spurred by oversold conditions. You know, there was a strong jobs report and retail holiday report that came out. That was that MasterCard Pulse report, as well as hope on a pause in monetary policy. We just heard that last week from Chairman Jerome Powell. And now the balance sheet is still set to shrink on the Fed's sheet. And following his patient comments from last Friday, Powell actually spoke this week again in a little Q&A session with David Rubenstein. He reiterated that the Fed can be patient. Okay, we heard this before. As did many other Fed officials, which we saw in the Fed minutes released this week. But he also added that the Fed's balance sheet will be substantially smaller than it is now. So that actually agitated investors a little bit on Thursday, but he did say it still will be larger than it has been before. The substantially smaller comment was not unnoticed, like I said, but it didn't seem to cause a panic. The market didn't roll over, and we're kind of overbought short term, and that's been looked at as pretty positive that we weathered those kind of comments. We've weathered many other issues, a lot of warnings that have come out. This week was a continuance of those guidance calls down, like we saw from Apple last week, and a few others throughout this week. So speaking of earnings, financials will be kicking things off for the fourth quarter earnings season starting on Monday. Let's talk about that more in a sec. So let's just talk about all these warnings and guidance calls here. So this week, Samsung, off the heels of Apple, gave also a warning themselves about profit. And taking a look at their business, they said specifically that their memory chip business demand was down. And so that, looking at the other semiconductors across the board, took a sizable hit this week when comments like that were made. On the flip side, so on the other side of the coin, Skyworks Solution, a supplier of Apple on many things, and of course they've got their other products, issued a profit warning, but it was better than expected. And that combined with an upgrade by Micron Technology, or an upgrade for them, the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index rose substantially later on in the week. So this was a group that there was a lot of concerns that, hey, they're not participating, the market's heading higher, what gives? And so seeing them come roaring back here towards the end of the week, that was seen as another positive sign. Now, American Airlines cut guidance by narrowing the revenue per available seat mile, I think is what it's called, down from a range of 1.5% to 3%, that's the range, 1.5 to 3, to just 1.5. So they narrowed the range, and of course, at the lower end. And that was not looked at favorably. Turning towards Macy's, they guided lower, and that hit the retail industry group pretty hard. And across the board, while as there was some other companies that, like Bed Bath & Beyond, which did guide, but they said, you know, things are going to be less bad. That stock's rallied substantially from that kind of announcement. Finally, General Motors, another stock that launched this week on guidance, and that was based on cost cutting, strong demand for its light trucks, and they mentioned China, that they've made some real headway there. And so that guiding higher there in the General Motors group that got people thinking about autos, you know, housing, autos. These are all areas that there's been a lot of concerns with rising interest rates, that these are areas that are slowing. I know we've talked about housing topping back in the third quarter and a few other things. So seeing results like that really kind of assures investors that maybe this isn't a deep growth slowdown concern right now. So let's talk about earnings. So we've heard the guidance this week. We start earnings next week with the financials. So Citibank on Monday, Wells Fargo and JP Morgan before the bell Tuesday, Goldman Sachs, Bank of New York Mellon, and Bank of America on Wednesday. Now, this group has been having a tough time of things, keeping up with the rest of the market with a flat yield curve. And of course, we got BlackRock mentioning that they were cutting on jobs. Revenues are only expected to go up for Citigroup, JP Morgan, and the Bank of New York for the fourth quarter. If the financials aren't engaging with the rally, that's a clear technical concern, just as we need yields to go up on good economic data to be assured that we've got growth here. Interesting. Some of these names are trading at single-digit price-to-earnings ratios on forward-looking 12-month estimates. So there are some deals out there if you think that, you know, the market got things wrong and earnings are expected to be up this year. Got to watch the financials next week. We just have to. Investors will respond to whether they guide higher or lower on forward guidance for 2019, and we'll get to see how investors react to that news. Got to watch the financials. Technology giants and semiconductors will also be a group down the road in the next couple of weeks that we'll need to be following closely. So since we're headed into the earnings season next week, let's talk about a few numbers to be aware of. Earnings per share are expected to grow at 10.6% versus a year ago, with revenue up 5.6%. Both of those stats are under the growth numbers we saw from a year ago. So the bar on comparisons here is set fairly high, and it'll get even worse as we go into the 2019 first quarter. Most knew that it inevitably earnings growth would slow down here, and expectations have been radically reduced during that recent market correction for what to expect here in 2019. So where are those expectations? Right now, FactSet thinks that we'll be growing at 6.9% for the full year, and that's down from where expectations were for growth in 2018 at 20.1%. Obviously, obviously, big drop there. So investors have a lot to think about this earnings season, but I don't think it's psychologically as dire as investors anticipated it was in December, given we have a Fed put now. Essentially, they can be patient, they're willing to wait, and the jobs numbers are good. Inflation is average, and the holiday sales reports we've seen, they've been good, Chris.
Well, thank you, Ryan. We appreciate that. And here at Financial Sense, we want to also issue our own warning, a warning that we will, every week, have a very condensed report on the catalysts and drivers that moved the market for the week. Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
2019 is going to be a tricky year for investors. The big shift that we're going to see for most of 2019 is the fact that U.S. growth is going to continue to slow. This week on FS Insider, we spoke with Simon White at Variant Perception, who gave us an update on their leading economic data, both for the U.S., the globe, and a number of different things that they're looking at. Here's what he had to say about 2019 in the U.S.
2019 is going to be a bit more tricky. And I'd say the big paradigm shift will be the fact that U.S. growth, which we characterized at the end of last year as being as good as it gets, is going to begin to start to roll over. So we're going to start to see more weaker data points. And it's not like a clap. So we have our leading indicator for the US, which gives a 6-month lead. And that's begun to roll over, but at a high level. So it's not like we're expecting to see anything particularly serious right now in terms of a reduction in growth. But you're definitely going to begin to see a rolling over.
Simon also gave an update on their global leading indicators, an outlook for Fed rate hikes this year, and how this is going to influence the U.S. dollar, which is very important when we think about different asset classes. We talked about their near-term considerations for the stock market, given the rally that we've seen so far, and then any clear investment implications that stem from their outlook. This interview with Simon did run just under 30 minutes, and it gave a really good overview of Variant Perception's overall outlook. And I should also mention that we subscribe to and pay very close attention to Variant Perception's research when it comes to investing for our own clients here at Financial Sense Wealth Management. So if you want to get the inside scoop on what we discussed this week with Simon White, we encourage you to hear what he had to say on this week's Insider program. If you're not a subscriber, go to financialsense.com and click subscribe.
As we begin this year, the good news, at least for the moment, is the markets are in positive territory, especially after the downfall in the month of December. We've got markets up low single digits. Is this a bear market rally, a dead cat bounce, or is better news ahead? Joining us on the program is John Kosar from Asbury Research. John, before we begin looking at the stock market, I want to come back to something that you said on our show, and this goes back to April, May of last year when I had you on. You were saying something unusual you hadn't seen since 2008, and that was the price of oil was rising and the commercials were heavily short and they were getting killed. And then when I had you on after summer recess, the price of oil was heading up to almost record levels for the year. The commercials were still heavily short. And we always considered the commercials smart money. They were looking like dumb money until we got to October. But here's the point I want to get to. In 1 month, we went from a bull market to a bear market with the drop of 20%. Fast forward another month, we were down 45% the day before Christmas. In the last couple of weeks, we're up 25%. So in a 2-month period, we went from a bull market to a bear market to a bull market in 2 months. Explain that to our listeners. I'd like to get your take on that.
Well, going back to the short position by the smart money commercial hedgers, I was looking at that all year because they had accumulated a record net short position, maybe about $55, $60 a barrel. And I'm looking at a chart of WTI crude right now, and we got up to about $76 a barrel. So they just took a heck of a beating. And what I was afraid of is back in, I think it was 08, I don't recall, but there was another situation where oil was trading at $130 a barrel in the futures market, $140 a barrel. And part of that rally, that unprecedented rally up to those sky-high levels, was because you had another situation where the commercial hedgers had been short, heavily short. Basically, they were hedged. You know, they were making a big bet that oil prices were too high, about $70. And it finally got to the point where they had to cover those shorts. And a lot of that move in $130, $140 a barrel was short covering. So I was afraid we were going to see the same thing this time. It didn't happen. You know, we broke, I'm looking at WTI spot crude now. You know, we broke the 200-day moving average there right about Halloween. And then, you know, the bottom fell out. And it looks like the hedgers had to take a heck of a lot of heat. But in the end, you know, they were right. They were just extremely early. And the frustrating thing right now is because the government is closed down, I haven't been able to look at COT data in several weeks. So I don't know how this move, I don't know how the hedgers actually responded to this move, because we're flying blind until we can get the government back to work.
Well, and who knows when that's going to happen. So let's move on to the stock market. Last year, if you would have talked about what was going on in the market with earnings and also the economy, the fundamentals looked pretty good, but that wasn't the way we ended the year. In your recent piece, you think we're at sort of a decision point for the market. Explain that, and what are you seeing?
I do. There's kind of a two-part to this. The first part, the intermediate-term part, 1 to several quarters out, let's call it. Back on both sides of Christmas, Christmas Eve and the day after, that's when we made the lows. Those lows were actually the market dropping into some secular underlying support levels in the NYSE Composite, in the S&P 500, and then the Dow Transports. Went down to trend lines that originated either in March of 2009 or at the 2011 lows. So you had a lot of underlying support there that went back many years. Meanwhile, similar support levels were tested in three key sector ETFs: the XLY, which is consumer discretionary, XLI, which is industrials, and XLV, which is healthcare. And all three of those, by the way, are very highly correlated to the S&P 500 and have been at various intervals over the last 20 years. So you've got all this support underneath, market dove down into it, it jumped back over it. And while those support levels were being hit, the VIX spiked up to over 30. There's an indicator that I actually built 10 years ago that measures the velocity of investor assets going in and out of the money market. Well, those had spiked, a lot of money going into the money market right at the end of December, indicating that people were pulling their money out of more risky assets and hiding under their bed. Investor sentiment was at multi-year extreme negatives at that time. And if I didn't mention it already, the put-call ratio was extremely high. Historically, and I went back about 20 years to look at this, when you bounce off of a major support level and you have those signs of capitulation, you know, VIX, put-call ratios and such, unless you are in a extended bear market, those usually turn out to be multi-quarter bottoms. So now I'm looking at those December lows as a potential multi-quarter major market bottom. The other side of that is going a little more near term. The S&P 500 has been underneath its 200-day moving average for several months now. It indicates a major downtrend. Meanwhile, 55 of the 60 global stock indexes that we track here are also trading underneath their 200-day moving averages, which means we're in a global major downtrend in equities. So now the S&P has bounced back up to 2,600, which we have as a important primary overhead resistance level. It's testing it as we speak. I'm looking at the chart. And we are monthly overbought. What does that mean? It means if the major downtrend is still intact, it should die at 2,600 and roll back over and retest those lows. So simply stated, we are kind of in the middle grounds between where the major downtrend is, as defined by the 200-day moving average, should re-engage on one side, and we're at a potential multi-quarter bottom if you look at a more of a intermediate term kind of an outlook. So we're right at this pivot point. If we can start trading up above 2600, and I look at six market internals every day that we call the Asbury Six. It's actually something we put up on our website every day. So our subscribers can take the market's temperature every day and see how healthy, you know, the internals look on a day-by-day basis. Right now, four of those six are positive. If we can get up above 2600 and stay there, I think that gives a lot more credence to there's a tangible bottom down at the D's lows. And that would suggest another 150 points higher to test the 200-day moving average, which right now is about 2740. If we roll over here at 2600 and head south again, I think we have a chance of going back and revisiting those lows. If we break them, I think there could be another 5 to 10% on the downside in store a little later this year. And, you know, we're looking at a flattening yield curve, 10th year of a bull market. U.S. government's been shut down for 3 weeks. There's talk by Fitch, you know, possibly downgrading, you know, U.S. bonds. There's just a whole lot of stuff out there that can really affect this either way.
John, when you get into a period like this where you're at a key pivot point and you have all these unknown variables in terms of how they play out, the government shutdown, et cetera, what do you do as an investor? Do you play this cautiously, maybe keep some powder dry, or do you just basically just stand aside?
That's such a fantastic question because it's something that I've been beating the drum on all year. We go on an annual break in between the holidays, and so our first day officially back was on January 2nd. So on January 2nd, yeah, we put out a report, strategy report, that suggested that investors that, you know, were holding some cash, they put a, you know, I call it a toehold investment. In other words, when you're not sure you have a bottom yet, but you think you might, you put a little money to work down there because if it is a bottom, it's a great way, you know, to build a position. And every time you put on some new money, your average is underneath the price of the market. So we suggested doing that on January 2nd. That was about 100 points lower than where the S&P 500 is right now. Our next thing is, just as I said, we're watching 2600. If 2600 holds the market and it rolls back down, we have plenty of time to take that first initial investment, let's call it 20%, off, and then we fold our arms and we wait for the market's next move. If 2600 is broken, and I need to see some internal market strength and us to start to trade consistently over 2600 for a week or 3-4 days, it depends what the internals look like, then I think you put on another tranche. Then I think you put on another chunk of available assets to work. And now your average is probably somewhere around 2550, about 50 S&P points underneath the market. And then you look for the 200-day. So I think, you know, the way you do this, you know, going back a step, the longer that I do this, the more I realize getting the market direction right is not the most important thing. Of course, it's important, but more importantly, you know, we do this to make money. More important than getting the, you know, market direction right is where you put your trades on, is where you put your positions on. If you are consistently selling the lows and buying the highs, which investors do all the time, which is why investor sentiment works so well, you could be right on the market's direction and still lose money. So, you know, I'm getting off a little bit from your question, but yeah, I mean, we really keep track of levels and we try to put a little bit of money near the bottom where we think, you know, the bottom might be, and then we build our position from there.
I want to go back to another anomaly. One we talked about as we began with oil. The other one is the safety trade. If we go back to February of last year when the stock market gave back its gains in 6 days, the safety trade didn't work. If you were in bonds, you were losing money. If you were in stocks, you were losing money. If you were in gold, you were losing money. And when the market started to turn in October, the first month, if you were in bonds, bonds went down along with stocks. But John, in November, the safety trade flipped because you had gold starting to go up and you had bond yields starting to drop. I want to get your take on that. How do you see that playing out now?
Well, I just put out a report on the bond market, the U.S. bond market yesterday, and there's some pretty compelling evidence in the work that we do. And, you know, we use a lot of wonky indicators that I won't get into here, but there's a pretty strong indication that we have made a peak in long-dated treasury prices. Let's look at the 10-year as a benchmark, the 10-year note traded at the CBOT. We think there's a very tangible top in place at, I'm actually going to the chart now, right around 123. You know, we peaked at 123 on January 3rd, and we're heading down. In the meantime, when yields, about a quarter ago, when yields couldn't stay up above 313, which we had as really a secular decision point, this is U.S. 10-year yields, and we started heading back underneath 3%, we had a target of 260 to 249. We got about 255-ish, 250 intraday, and now we're starting to head up again. Our work strongly suggests that this quarter, we're going to go back up and revisit that 290 to 3% area. So that would suggest money actually coming out of bonds. If the trade works like it typically does, and there's money coming out of bonds, that would argue that we take out the 2600 area in the S&P as money come out of bonds and go back into equities. So that's kind of how I'm anticipating, first of all, what I think interest rates are going to do here over the next 1 to 2 to 3 months and how that might affect the stock market.
All right. What about the price of gold?
Gold's at a really tricky place here. Gold is, I'm actually going back to the chart now. Gold peaked back in 2011. It dropped very hard into the end of 2015. The lows we made there right at the end of 2015 kind of moved sideways for a couple of years. And then we actually broke down back mid-year last year, a little bit after the 4th of July. We had broken down. Now we're coming up and retesting that area that we broke down from. So in my view, if gold can hold in here and continue to strengthen, then I can say we have a very tradable bottom down at the lows that we made the end of the summer of last year. If gold starts to weaken from here, I think we can move significantly lower. And you know, the initial target on that first breakdown that I talked about that we made at the middle of last year, it targets $1,000 an ounce. But in order for that to be true, gold has to be making a peak here. So in other words, if gold peaks here, I think we're back to $1,000 an ounce at some point quarters in the future. If gold can stay up above 1260, I think we've got a tangible bottom at the lows we made at the middle of last year. If we can hold 1260, then it would suggest to me that the bigger move down that we started back in 2011 is re-engaging, and we could see a big, big break in gold this year.
Your comment about gold hitting 1,000 is rather interesting, because Byron Wien, in his annual surprises for 2019, one of them, John, was gold hits $1,000. So maybe he's looking at the same charts you're looking at, because that's interesting that you mentioned $1,000.
Yeah, we were talking $1,000 the middle of last year, and we had a break. It became oversold, and we had a relief rally. Right now, I can't tell if this is a relief rally or if it's the start of something, you know, that could actually be a launching pad for gold to go a whole lot higher. The only good thing about this chart is this 1290 area is very obvious to me. This 1260 to 1290 area, I'm looking at nearby futures right now, is a fulcrum, a price fulcrum, you know, is what we call them here. If it holds 1260, the market's good, and I think it can go considerably higher. If we fail here and fall back below 1260, you can potentially have a very bad year for gold. So whichever way you think gold is going, you know, your risk reward here is pretty good. You know, if you're bullish, 1260-ish is where you need to hold. If you're negative, you know, you're waiting for it to go back through 1260 to put on that trade. Otherwise, you just cross your hands and wait. So this area does give you a little leverage, you know, for a positive or a negative position.
You know, that's rather interesting, because you mentioned two key points here. If we're talking about the stock market, holding 2,600 and breaking through that is a, let's say, a signal to go long. And if you're looking at gold, if we hold 1,260, it's a signal to go long as well. But if, let's say, 2,600 on the S&P and 1,260 are broken, obviously you go in the opposite direction. John, a final question. During the Christmas holidays, there was an extensive interview with Stanley Druckenmiller. And if our listeners aren't familiar with him, he was managing director with George Soros. He went off on his own as a hedge fund manager. The guy was making annual returns of 20%. And the interviewer asked him a question about the changing makeup of the market with algo trading and machines and passive investing. He said it's made his job more difficult, and at times market signals have been confusing. I'd like to get your take on the composition and technological change of the markets as we close.
I totally agree with that comment. I mean, I've been doing this almost 40 years. I started on the trading floor when I was a kid in the 1980s. And I can tell you that my job is a heck of a lot harder now than it was 10 years ago. When I was in the pit, this is a pretty good analogy, I think, just on a much bigger scale. When I was in the pit as a kid, there were order fillers and there were locals. You know, the locals were the guys that were trading their own account. You know, they were in the pit scalping, they used to call it. You know, they would be trying to buy the lows and sell the highs. And what these guys would often do is, based on charts, these locals, which were scalpers trading for their own account, they had a pretty good idea of where the orders were, you know, where the stop loss orders might be, because you might have a trend line or an old low or something. So what they would do is they would try to push the market intraday down underneath those sell stops and hit them. And then all those sells would be executed in the market, and it would temporarily drive the market down even lower. So temporarily, in other words, by triggering orders that investors put in so that they could protect themselves, it could force the market to do something unusual for a short period of time. I see the algo guys doing that now, but on a much larger scale. You see a lot of trend lines being temporarily broken, you know, just for a day or two or 3 days, and the market comes ripping back. What that does is it forces investors to get out of their longs and maybe go short. And once they do that, you know, the market turns again and it goes the other way, forces them to get out. So they basically catch your average trader flat-footed on both sides of the trade. And there's a lot of money to be made there. I mean, you know, the locals in the pit, you know, were doing it 40 years ago. And I see that happening now. Again, conspiracy theory, whatever. That's what it looks like to me, because I'm just seeing levels that used to hold. You know, these trend lines they talked about right around Christmas time, you know, they were broken for 2-3 days and the market came ripping back. It's a poster boy for what I see over and over and over again, is where somehow these algo guys, it seems to me, may have figured out. Everybody can see these levels. I mean, if you're a technician, you know, you could find the levels, but it almost looks like the levels are being, you know, regularly broken for a short period of time to get people, you know, to get rid of their, to stop themselves out of their longs, or, you know, get out of their short positions, and then immediately flip the market the other way. So yeah, you know, that's the long answer, but I see a lot of parallels between what I used to see in the pit and what I'm seeing on a much bigger scale now.
In summary, John, as we conclude here, a couple key areas for investment asset classes. If we're looking at the S&P, it needs to hold 2,600. If it breaks out above that, you can put money to work. If it breaks down, well, keep some powder dry. Looking at gold, it needs to hold 1,260. If it doesn't, it's going in the opposite direction, possibly 1,000. But if it holds 1,260, well, we may get a nice uprun here. John, as we close, tell our listeners about the great work that you do at Asbury and how they can find out more about you.
If you would like a sample copy of what we do, some information about us, the best way to do that is to go to the website, asburyresearch.com, and go to the contact tab. It's all the way on the right side of the screen. And there's a simple little form to fill out with your name and your email address, your phone number, if you like. And we will contact you. And we'll send you a couple of free reports, show you what we do. If you like it, there's a couple of different price points. We've got special pricing for individual investors, and we'd love to hear from you.
All right. Well, listen, John, hopefully the government will get back to working order and we can find out what the smart money commercials are doing in the oil pits. Thanks so much. And by the way, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you and all your listeners. I look forward to another year of doing your shows. They're great.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
With a slowdown in global growth for most of 2018, emerging markets were hit pretty hard, and investors are now dipping their toe back into the space as better valuations emerge. According to Alex Barrow in MacroOps, however, emerging markets still have long-term headwinds that they're facing. Here's a clip where he contrasts the somewhat brief problems that we saw in the EM space, the emerging market space, around the late 90s versus what we see today.
This time is different, though, because if you look at emerging market share of global exports, they make up roughly 50% of global exports. That's saturated. Now, when these EMs get into these balance of payment crisis, they can't go and just start boosting their share of global exports because it's already reasonably maxed out. So now all they can do is cannibalize the share of exports from one another.
Barrow also goes on to explain the influence of China when it comes to the future outlook for many emerging markets, what will need to happen for a meaningful bottom, and where he thinks investors should be concentrating their investments currently. To listen to this and all of our FS Insider podcasts on our site or any podcast app of your choice from your mobile device, simply go to financialsense.com and click where it says subscribe. Whether it's economic trends, geopolitics, global macro, stocks, commodities, or bonds, we provide regular updates and forecasts 3 days a week, material that is often reserved for large institutions, hedge funds, and high net worth investors. So go ahead, give it a try. Again, go to financialsense.com, click where it says subscribe, or if you have any questions whatsoever, feel free to give us a call at 858-487-3939.
We saw the price of oil last year hit prices we haven't seen in almost 3 or 4 years. But as soon as they were hitting record levels, within 30 days, the price of oil dropped 40%, sending it in a bear market. So what does all of that mean? One reason given for it is the global economy is slowing down. Number two, there's a huge oil glut like we saw between 2014 and 2016. Or is there something else at work here? Joining me on the program is Dan Steffens from Energy Perspectives. Dan, I'd like to get your take, because if you take a look at the price of oil, I don't care if you're looking at WTI or Brent, from the beginning of last year, as the oil markets tightened as OPEC stuck to their production cuts, the price was steadily rising. And then in May of last year, it really took off leading up until those highs in early October. And then all of a sudden, they fell off a cliff and they were down 40% in bear market territory. I'd like to get your take as to what was behind this. Was it fundamentals or was it something else?
Well, actually, you know, from the first part of the year, the market was tightening, and like during all rebound phases, there's stops and starts, but it was going up in a pretty steady stair-step fashion. There was several pullbacks, but you mentioned May. That's when the Trump announced that the United States would be pulling out of the treaty with Iran, the nuclear treaty, because they didn't believe they were really complying with it, and that he was going to slap sanctions on anyone that purchased oil from Iran, and it was going to start in the first week of November. And they had several press conferences. He was sending out the Treasury Secretary, Secretary of State, and they were making these bold statements that their goal was to take Iranian production to zero, our exports to zero, basically blockading the country and not allowing any of their oil to reach market. And they were going to do this by putting severe financial sanctions on any country or company that would continue doing business with Iran. And they gave him this grace period to get out, and it was falling. So at the time of the May announcement, Iran was putting out like 3.5 million barrels a day into the market. And, you know, by early or late October, early November, they cut down by over 1 million barrels a day. And then, you know, when the deadline approached, I think. And, you know, Trump's putting out these tweets that he wants Saudi Arabia to increase their production to make up for the difference, and, you know, keeps putting the blame on them for higher gasoline prices. And they comply, and they do, you know, put out more because they think he's telling the truth and going to put the sanctions on. Well, then you get to the date of the sanction, and they immediately announce that 8 countries have waivers to continue importing about 2 million barrels a day from Iran. Now, they're just 6-month waivers, so they expire in the first week of May. But when that announcement came out, it was just like every hedge fund all at the same time hit the sell button. In fact, I heard rumors that it was later confirmed that a very large hedge fund had gone long oil and short on natural gas, and they were on the wrong side of that trade on both when oil started pulling back. At the same time, you know, we're having a cold start to November and the natural gas prices are spiking, and they had to, you know, close all their positions in both oil and gas. So it caused gas to go higher, caused oil just to fall off a cliff. And, you know, once that trading starts, the algorithms that drive all this computerized trading, they just start feeding on themselves. It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. And every day they're just sell. And until they're, you know, at some bottom set, it just keeps going. And so the fall off was way below where it should have settled. Now, basically, if you ask me on the fundamentals, it should have settled around 65. The first week of October, oil was trading for $76 a barrel. This is West Texas Intermediate. Brent was, you know, $85, $90 a barrel. And so it should have dropped maybe $10 or $15 a barrel at most, and then settled in the lower half from 60 to 65, in my opinion, is the right price for oil. But the program tradings just took it off the cliff, and it went all the way down to seemed to be settling at 50, and then it took another dive to 45. So hopefully we've seen the lowest price in that trading right around Christmas, and it looks like we're going to settle today over 50.
I want to talk about the increase in production, which also surprised everybody, with the U.S. overtaking Russia as the world's largest producer of oil as a result of shale production. But Dan, if you take a look at even today, as we're currently over $50, or it looks like we're going to settle in that area, you take a look at what is going on in shale. I think the lowest producing area of shale is the Permian. It's somewhere around $51 a barrel. If you look at the Bakken, it's probably in the upper 50s, 60s. So if we're sitting here at $50, there's a lot of oil out there that companies cannot make money. They're losing money on cash flow. And in the past, when oil went down, a lot of these companies that were in that area were able to roll over their debt, and so they could keep things going. Now we're seeing credit spreads widen. There's a little bit more reluctance on corporate refinancing. And so let's talk about the economics of shale if oil remains at 50. I think it's going higher just simply because of economics. You can't produce oil in the Permian at 50 and make a profit.
Right. If the OPEC Plus group follows through on their agreement, and there's no indication that they won't, and they take, you know, 1.2 to 1.5 million barrels a day off the market, and, you know, demand, there's not a global recession. Today, the oil markets are pretty well balanced, so it should move back to, quote, right price. But in all the plays, just think of them, there's a lot of tier one acreage. There's tier one, tier two, tier three. And the tier one acreage, you can make money at $30 on oil if you got really good, you know, on the drilling cost. These wells cost, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 million on these 2-mile long laterals to complete them. So you need pretty good price, but these wells are going to produce 1 million barrels over the life. So that's $50 million gross revenues, and it only costs $10 million to, you know, drill them. But the reason U.S. production growth has slowed pretty dramatically is because companies had drilling contracts, but they can lay off some completion crews, and basically they'll drill the wells, they'll run casing, but they won't complete them. And that's a smart economic move because these are high decline rate wells. They come on very strong. They have hyperbolic decline curves, and they'll produce about half of their total reserves that they'll ever produce. They produce in the first, you know, 2 years that they're online, and then they'll produce the other half over maybe a 15, 20 year period. It'll still be economic. I mean, these are, you know, flowing wells, but they pay out quickly. You don't want to complete them into a low price environment if you can help it.
I want to talk about another fundamental factor that kicks in next year, and that is the maritime agreement that requires low sulfur fuel to be used by all ships plying the seas. I mean, nobody's talking about that and the impact that will have on fuel and, for example, diesel. So let's talk about that and how that might play out over the next 12 to 18 months.
Yeah, it's the name of it is IMO 2020, and that IMO stands for International Maritime Organization. And these regulations were passed several years ago, actually 4 or 5 years ago, that they would go into effect on January 1st, 2020. And the organization and all of the countries have signed on to it, and they're going to support it. And there's been some talk of them delaying it, but that has not been even considered. And they said they're going to go forward with it. And in order to comply with it, you have to burn this low sulfur fuel. And now they can burn shipping oil, bunker fuel, whatever, that has like a 2.5, let's say 2.5 of sulfur in it. Now they have to go down to less to 0.5 with this new regulation. And that effectively is going to take 1.5 to 2 million barrels a day off of the global market, like immediately when it goes into effect. And actually, it's gradually starting to go into effect because, you know, it's not like every ship is going to just burn the high sulfur fuel until December 31st. They're all already starting to head that way. And the only way to deal with it is to put a multi-million dollar scrubber on the ship to clean the oil right before you burn it, or you have to buy that cleaned up fuel. And so there's going to be this garbage oil that everybody was still burning out in the ocean that nobody can use anymore. And so it's a big deal. And it's going to be a big spike in oil demand heading into 2020.
Let's move on to what may happen, because there's very few analysts on the street that are bullish on oil. One firm that is fairly bullish on oil is Raymond James. They think we see a gradual pickup in the price of oil. And then by the time we get into the second half of the year, that's when things are really going to look good. For the price of oil, they expect it to be higher. And of course, we just talked about the IMO that kicks into 2020, which could take off a lot. And not to mention, Dan, one of the big stories in the Wall Street Journal this week is Saudi Arabia is thinking about cutting back their exports to the U.S. by almost 800,000 barrels. So, I mean, that'll whittle down inventories very quickly. But let's talk about the energy stocks. I guess investors, if you take a look at oil, you take a look at energy stocks, they've underperformed the market over the last 4 or 5 years, understandably, when the price of oil was going from 100 down to 26. You know, obviously that hurt a lot of companies' profits. But last year, when the price was rising, the oil stocks lagged the commodity price. And then when things went off the cliff, as they did in October, November, the stocks followed in suit. So let's talk about the energy stocks and what might lie ahead for investors if you're in the energy sector.
Yeah, it was a very weird year when you think about it for the energy stocks, because even at the end of the third quarter, when oil had opened the year at about $60 a barrel and had gone to, you know, almost $70 a barrel at the end of the third quarter, almost all the upstream companies that I follow were down 15, 20, some 30%. Year to date, even though they were putting up very strong profits, you know, some of the best numbers I've seen in a long time. And the one thing to remember is we do not need $100 oil anymore. These wells are coming on stronger. They figured out better ways to complete them. The drilling costs and the completion costs had come down. So what the new 100 is probably $65 or $70. You're not making the same profit per well at 60 to 65 that you were making at $100 oil 3 or 4 years ago. So investors need to keep that in mind. I think one of the myths on Wall Street is that you need $100 oil for these companies to make money. And then people were citing a lot of these growth companies that because they outspent their cash flow, they were losing money. Well, that's like saying a real estate company that is outspending its cash flow to build new office buildings that are going to produce revenues for 20 or 30 years because they're building more assets, they're losing money. No, they're not. They're just adding more future revenues by building these, you know, great buildings. Well, it's the same way with these oil fields. They're developing oil fields they're going to produce for 15, 20 years, and they're spending money to do it now. You have to do that to grow. So I think the reality I think that's going to sink in for the oil stocks is that let's assume that we've hit bottom. Oil's not going to go any lower. We're going to establish a base in the low 50s here for a while, and then as we get into the higher demand period in the third quarter, and then we have this IMO 2020 rule coming into place. Like Raymond James says, we're going to start the year in first quarter with an average of $52 a barrel. That's looking pretty reasonable today. But we're going to end the year at $75 a barrel for WTI. If oil follows their price pattern here, I can give you a list of stocks right now. They should double or triple. I mean, they're selling at ridiculously low levels. They're selling at prices as if oil is going to stay at 40 forever. And it just isn't. It just can't, because you'd shut down so many projects around the world at $40 oil that we'd soon be in a deep deficit.
I want to bring up another thing, and that is, first of all, last year, if you take a look at the FANG stocks, the technology stocks, so oil had a lot of competition from other sectors within the market. But the other thing, Dan, that permeates the energy industry, and you saw this on the front cover of The Economist, the death of the, the gasoline engine. And, in 10 years, you and I are all going to be driving electric cars. And I want to share a story with our listeners, because my nephew recently bought a Tesla. He lives in Arizona. He was driving over to come visit us in San Diego. First thing he had to do is stop off in Yuma, and it took 45 minutes to charge his engine. I mean, when I drive to Phoenix, it's 5 minutes, fill the pump, and I'm back on the road. The other thing, when he got to San Diego, he had to find Tesla charge stations because his battery was on low. So I just don't think, Dan, that number one, the cost of electric cars, they'll eventually come down. But the infrastructure is in place, because you have a lot of people saying, well, oil is the past. We're leaving that era, and we're all going to be driving Teslas or some kind of electric car. I just don't see that in the next 10 years. We don't have the infrastructure. It's more expensive. And in his car, it was supposed to be 300 miles on battery charges, more realistically, 200. So let's talk about the myth of, let's say, renewables and electric cars replacing, let's say, fuel demand.
First, let me say that thank God we have electric car technology, because if we didn't, we'd already be looking at $100, $150 oil, because we have to find something to, slow down this ever-increasing demand for transportation fuels. That said, it's going to take a long time before electric vehicles become a significant percentage of cars and trucks on the road, even if they do come up with batteries that can make the car go 400 or 500 miles. Unless they bring down the cost of the vehicles, you aren't going to get average Joe Blow throwing away his gasoline powered car to go with a battery. Now, I'm personally very bullish on the rechargeable battery technology sector, and it's just got a lot more upside than just electric cars. But that is a myth. I don't see demand for oil. Nobody is projecting demand for oil to roll over. The concept of peak demand a few years ago was just ridiculous. Demand for oil goes up by about 1.5%, 1.5 million barrels per day increase. We're now at over 100 million barrels a day of hydrocarbon-based liquids being consumed daily. Put that number in your brain and think a 30-day month. That's 3 billion barrels of oil consumed each month. So when you hear Exxon found a new billion-barrel oil field, well, that's 10 days of supply. The market is so large that people just cannot get their brain around it. They just can't comprehend. And the infrastructure that we have in the United States with, 400,000 or 500,000 filling stations, well, unless you have 100,000 or 200,000 recharging stations, on every corner we have one, I just don't see how the electric vehicles are going to be that much accepted. Now, they're going to keep growing, and they're great. I mean, the Teslas are great cars, but it's not as bearish for the oil and gas companies as people think it is.
All right, let's talk about another bearish element the bears would argue is the slowdown in China's economy, the largest consumer of oil imports in the world now, surpassing the United States. Even though the Chinese economy has slowed down, their own internal oil production has fallen down. China is still importing more oil last year than they did the year before. So this is another bearish argument that is thrown out there. Well, we're going through a global slowdown. And granted, if we were in a recession, we wouldn't be consuming as much oil. But let's talk about China. I mean, they're importing more oil and consuming more oil than they ever have in the past.
Yeah, right. The two countries that are creating the global demand increases are China and India. And they're about equal as far as how much they impact demand growth. And actually, one of the best bearish arguments for oil is if this Trump tariff trade war with China would continue. So any progress that's made on that, any kind of agreement that they can come to would be very bullish for oil prices. And actually, I mean, just this week, they've had meetings and it sounds like they're heading towards some kind of an agreement. And one of the pieces of the agreement that I'm hearing about is that China is going to import more oil and gas from the United States. That will help West Texas Intermediate WTI oil prices close the gap to Brent. So you have that going for it too. So yeah, the Chinese economy, the overall Asian and third world economies, that's where the demand growth is going to come from. So it is very important that the global economy doesn't go off a cliff. I personally think it may slow a little bit this year, but I don't think there's any threat of it going off the cliff.
So as we look at the oil sector today, what, in your opinion, what should investors be doing? Because, you know, if you take a look at the sell-off in oil was probably way overdone, given fundamentals. And every report I read from the EIA to the IEA to the OECD are still saying the economy is going to grow this year and oil demand is going to be up by over 1 million barrels a day. What should investors do? Because last year, if you were in oil stocks, you lost money, plain and simple. And if we expect the price of oil to go up this year, what are some of the factors that may change and make oil or energy stocks a better bet in 2019 than they were in 2018?
Well, they entered the year grossly oversold. I mean, just in this first 2 weeks of trading, our Sweet 16, which is our large cap growth portfolio, it's already up 10% just from the first of the year. So they start from such a grossly oversold point. And the one thing that your listeners need to remember is these good, high-quality companies can make money at $50 oil. They don't need $100 oil, so they're still making money. The other thing is they sell a mixture of products. So you need to look at their production mix. So they all sell crude oil, NGLs, that's natural gas liquids, and then they sell natural gas, dry gas. And each one of those markets is slightly different. Now, the big improvement in the second half of last year was the demand for NGLs. The U.S. petrochemical business is growing much faster than the global economy. And it's that petrochemical business that consumes a lot of natural gas as feedstock, but also the NGLs. So look at that. Then they should look at just the stability of the balance sheet and their debt. All debt is not the same. I mean, your credit card debt is not the same as your home mortgage. You have to look at the length of their debt. What's their senior debt? How much have they drawn down on their, you know, their current credit line, which I would say is more like credit card debt. It's due right now. And having access to capital is extremely important in this business. Having a strong balance sheet is extremely important in this business because you have to have access to capital to develop these fields because the wells cost $8 to $10 million. You know, they may have 10,000 drilling locations, but if they don't have the money to drill them, that acreage is worthless. So look at the you know, strength of their balance. And then also look at this, the rock matters, the rock quality matters. All the acreage in the Permian Basin is not the same. The Permian Basin is 19 million acres, and probably only 2 or 3 million acres of that is tier one. And the rest of it, you know, is sub-economic at today's price, but at $60 oil, maybe some of the tier two acreage becomes economic. At $100 oil, it's probably all very economic to develop. So you just need to look at the quality of the rock. So that matters.
You and I, Dan, think that the price of oil is heading up and that the sell-off was overdone. So there are a number of things that investors can do. The nice thing about the integrated stocks, like you say, they have strong balance sheets, they have dividends. And it's kind of nice getting a 4% and 5% dividend waiting for the stock to go up. As we close, Dan, I wonder if you might just tell our listeners, you are having a cruise coming up for energy investors and subscribers to your newsletter, and tell investors about your newsletter as we close.
Yeah, we put out a monthly newsletter called The View from Houston. And in it, we have three model portfolios. We have large cap growth, small cap growth, and then we have high yield. And actually, as you said, Jim, right now, there's some tremendous companies, really solid companies where you can get dividend yield in the 6%, 7%, 8%. There's some on our list that have 10 or 12% annual dividend yield and a strong history of increasing dividends year after year. So that's another area to look. Yeah, if you want to subscribe to our service, first of all, you can go to energyprospectus.com or just send us an email. And our email address is energyprospectus@gmail.com. And if your listeners just say they want the Jim Poplava discount, we'll give them $100 off their first year of membership.
All right. Well, Dan, listen, as always, thanks for joining us on the program, clarifying some of the things that we've seen take place in the oil market. Quite honestly, I've been following the energy market for almost 30, 40 years now, and I've never seen anything like what happened between October and November last year. I mean, we've seen drop-offs in oil as we did in 2014, but nothing this fast, furious, and violent in such a short period of time. Dan, as always, thanks so much for joining us on the program. A happy new year and all the best to you. And come back and talk to us again.
All right. Thanks a lot.
And in Hour 2, The Big Picture, Jim Poplava and I discuss our annual forecast, where we give you our own view of the markets for 2019. While there's been talk of a recession in 2019 or 2020, the numbers seem to tell a different story, and some of our conclusions may surprise you. We discuss what triggered the sell-off in oil and what happens when you approach the end of a Fed rate-raising cycle. Also discussed is the escalation of the trade war between the U.S. and China, and of course, political discord, as we now make history with the longest government shutdown ever. Stay tuned for Hour 2, The Big Picture, where we discuss Fast and Furious. Time to buckle up.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.